The following Real Assets Advisor podcast is a production of its parent company, IREI, Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For your most curated, intelligent news, data, and insights, visit realassetsadvisor.com and sign up today for our complimentary newsline and magazine using our new chat feature.
This podcast has been sponsored by Juniper Square. Juniper Square is transforming the private capital markets industry with solutions and services that streamline fundraising, investment operations, and investor reporting. Designed for commercial real estate, Juniper Square is trusted by hundreds of investment sponsors to manage more than $1 trillion in real estate investments. Reach Juniper Square at junipersquare.com.
Our guest is Ryan Gao. He's a director at Fiera Infrastructure in Canada, where a significant number of infrastructure projects have been funded by private investors and are underway. Mr. Gao participates in the origination and execution of new investment opportunities at Fiera, as well as contributing to asset management and fundraising at the organization. And with that, Ryan Gao, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Mike. Pleasure to be here today.
You know, it's great to have you. And I have to tell you, the last time I was in Canada, I was in Toronto, where you're based, as a matter of fact. And this is probably eight or 10 years ago, not quite 10, I think it was about 8 years ago. And when I went to Toronto, there were construction cranes everywhere. No, that's construction. But with construction comes infrastructure. I mean, clearly infrastructure needs to be in place for construction to take place. It was absolutely booming. Now, tell us a little bit about what's going on infrastructure-wise in Canada. For instance, what are the major projects that are currently underway? And what areas of Canada are these projects taking place in?
Yeah, you're exactly right. There's a lot of activity in the Canadian market on the construction side. And, you know, as a result, the infrastructure is being built in the major cities, coast to coast. If you haven't been there recently, the number of cranes has probably increased even since 8 to 10 years ago. We like to see that because what it's translating into is investment dollars, not only for the private sector, but public funding is coming in. The Canadian government has made tremendous commitments into building out infrastructure in these major cities. And it's really important for us in Toronto and those in Vancouver and out in the Maritimes to have that infrastructure. The projects that we're seeing and that really are, you know, present in the markets today and visible to the average person are really transportation linked projects. So we're seeing a lot of construction and development of light rail transit. There's projects taking place right now in Toronto. There's projects that have been completed in the Waterloo region. Ottawa has LRT projects that undergo, same with Edmonton. And these are important and really ones that have been being developed and discussed for years at all levels of government. And the reason is in order to boost the economy and have the GDP growth that we're aspiring to have in Canada is you need to have people that can get around, that are accessible to the various markets and that have that efficiency. So, you know, it's really a transition of what we've seen being developed and built. If you went back years ago, there was a huge boom for what was needed at the provincial level with the healthcare sector and hospitals being built and social and civic centers. The P3 model was used, for those that are familiar, the public-private partnership model was used heavily to develop those projects. And it's not to say they're not being developed and built today, but it transitioned into what we're seeing now as these larger scale transportation projects.
So transportation really out front on this round of spending and investment. And there's so much talk around the world about electrification of transportation. How electric are these transportation projects? Is that one of the, is there a policy from the Canadian government that we want to move towards electrification, move towards this whole effort to turn back climate change and basically take away greenhouse gas emissions as much as possible?
Yeah, ESG and climate change is front and center on all decisions, and whether it's infrastructure investors or whether it's public policymakers and you know, those that are looking at the design and construction of these projects. It's being considered, it's being evaluated. There is a lot of change that is taking place, though, as to what is the right approach. One particular project, and it's been, you know, it's still in those early development phases, but the main GO Transit line, which is our main commuter rail in the city of Toronto and in the greater Toronto area, that's a multi-billion dollar project being considered to electrify those tracks. And really, you know, how can you get the right technology in place to be there for futures to come? We're seeing that across all types of infrastructure projects, of and our investors at the same time are looking at that to say, you know, what's the ESG considerations, whether it's transportation or in the businesses that various private sector investors are coming into through infrastructure funds or otherwise. I think we've seen in Canada a lot as well. You know, we have a very big energy infrastructure market, you know, headquartered out of the West Coast in Alberta. And as a result, it's put a lot of focus and a lot of scrutiny for those large players as well on what are they doing to think of the next generation and coming to these climate change goals that everybody is signing up to. And I think you're seeing a lot of globally and in Canadian participants are really active in the net zero commitments. We've done it ourselves as a net zero asset manager. And it's really putting a spotlight on these considerations, and the transportation projects are no different.
Talk about the energy efforts being made out in I think you said Alberta. So, what are we talking? Solar, wind, geothermal, hydrogen? I mean, what types of energy are you know, transcendent as far as the current efforts go?
Yeah, there's a real mix. I mean, I think Alberta historically has been very focused on the oil and gas sector. They do have a very robust procurement, and what they're rolling out now is for renewable energy in the solar space in the province of Alberta. They've been doing RFPs, and there's now active development taking place. That originally started in the Ontario market. I'd say back 10 to 15 years ago, Ontario really started with the RESOP programs and the feed-in tariff programs. And the mandate from the government at the time was they wanted to get a significant amount of wind and solar developed and built in the province. Now, with that comes challenges. I think that with renewable energy, it's not a baseload energy source. And therefore, you need to manage the energy grid such that you are managing that, you know, intermittent power source. That's what's led to a lot of development as well across the country, and people looking at it and maybe getting to more of the newer forms of technology and ESG considerations around energy storage. You know, the largest energy storage project, which is being funded privately and being backed by government, is taking place right now in the Ontario market. And this is one aspect where there's a tremendous opportunity, and I think it's important in order for us to green the grid, is pairing energy storage with renewable energy sources. It allows that intermittent power source to then be utilized as more of a base load energy source. But at the end of the day, the needs that are required, I think I'm a strong believer that it's going to require a combination of energy sources, and there's not one solution to address all the needs across the country.
So getting back to the transportation projects, talk about the importance of them. You mentioned electrification in ESG. There's efforts to electrify these. Are there any high-speed rail being put in? Is there an effort to connect markets that are currently unconnected so that things can happen, such as we could actually recruit somebody from a different city and they can commute on a high speed rail, and it opens up several things. It means that they can live there and work for a company in a different city, and it also means it enlarges our recruitment palette. Particularly among people who want the job, but they for whatever reason they don't want to move because they may have family, they may have aging parents, they may have all kinds of commitments in that market. I feel like I'm putting words in your mouth, Ryan, but the importance of these transportation projects, what would you list off as what they're going to do for Canada in those particular cities?
Yeah, no, and you're exactly right, actually. There are certain projects that are being considered today. Two come to mind, earlier stages as well, but one actually is interesting, and it came about by an unsolicited bid. This as well is taking place in Alberta, early days today, but it's to create a Hyperloop and really a high-speed train that's connecting the major cities across Alberta. And what it does for people really is it allows, exactly as you said, the mobility of people across major hubs. And what they're looking for is efficiency, and they're looking for certainty in their travel schedules. And it really, I mean, Canada, we have a very large landmass, but are concentrated into major cities. The majority of the population lives in the major cities, but there is a large rural population. And I think, you know, a big focus of transportation is that whether it's the Hyperloops being considered in Alberta, high-speed rail that's being considered right now between Toronto and Montreal, it's to create greater connectivity amongst the people. And in the transportation space, these are large multi-billion dollar projects that will take many years. And it also requires the cooperation and coordination amongst both municipalities and provincial governments, in some cases, the federal government. It's one way that in Canada, you know, things, it's not unique, but there is three levels of government. And we do need to look at the infrastructure that's being developed at each level of government and understand where that decision-making body is and where the funding comes from. We're in an interesting situation, I guess, in Canada, in that majority of the infrastructure needs today are at the municipal level of government when we speak of public infrastructure. And the challenge with that is the municipal governments are the level of government with the least financial resources in order to execute on those longer term, larger capital expenditure projects. And as a result, the federal government is looking to support them quite a bit. And so I think when we think of these transportation projects and what may be the great connectivity between major cities, hyperloops and high-speed rail, it's going to require a concerted effort amongst many levels of government in order to do so. What we're seeing, when I mentioned earlier, what we see around light rail transit, and that's what's happening in really more densely populated areas of the country, that is really a solution to what is a natural and a growing urban centers is congestion, and therefore productivity gets impacted negatively when people cannot get to places they want to go efficiently. So it all goes back to infrastructure and why do you have, what do you want to make sure that a country has strong infrastructure like transportation around cities? Is that it's the backbone of the economy. It's what allows people to remain connected, get to places of work efficiently, look for opportunities in different areas of a city or different areas of a province. And so very critical. And I think that we're right now at this point, seeing across the country a huge focus on transportation that is really taking cars off the road, allowing people to live in different areas of the country, but still be connected to different hubs.
How does the level of PPP, which you mentioned earlier, public-private partnership, which allows private investors to play in this arena, how does the level of PPP activity compare now versus historically? Has it been amplified? Is it the sort of thing where it's being emphasized in a bigger way than it has been in the past? And if so, why?
Well, it's interesting. The public-private partnership model really has been around and being utilized in Canada probably since the early 2000s. And it really was heavily utilized, as I mentioned earlier, around the healthcare space and social infrastructure. And as a result, those projects, which we and the development side of things would say are simpler to construct and build versus a transportation project, the different governments that were utilizing them, and predominantly in that case, it was the provincial governments, because healthcare and social infrastructure is really under the provincial regulation. So those projects we were seeing back in, I'd say, 2005 to 2010 range, a lot more procurements as far as the number of projects, because they were, whether you think of, if you think of a hospital or you think of a civic center, it's on a single plot of land. Permitting is much simpler, and you can really get the shovels into the ground and have projects built and in operation within a 2 to 3 year time frame. And then what happened was we really got to that critical scale, and provinces started to see, okay, we're where we need to be. They need to be a little more strategic. What's the next priority? And that's where transportation came into play, and applying the public-private partnership model to transportation projects. There's certainly challenges in trying to do so, and the reason for that is the complexity of a transportation project like a light rail transit or a bus rapid transit project. Really goes up quite a bit when you compare that to, say, a courthouse or a civic operations center. The permitting and the interface going across multiple parcels of land can be quite challenging. And so the development time period to that has been prolonged, and the construction period of those types of projects is prolonged relative to a traditional social infrastructure project. What it has resulted, though, in from an investment perspective is it costs a lot more to develop and construct those types of projects. And so it's increased the amount of investment dollars necessary in order to build those. So although we might be seeing less volume of projects, we're seeing larger projects, and the trend has been continuing that way. What also is unique, I think, in the application of the public-private partnership model is it's really changed across the country. The two major hubs originally for the public-private partnership model was out in British Columbia and in Ontario. Those markets still exist, but it really now has been adapted and is being utilized quite effectively in the maritime provinces. So the smaller provinces within Canada have tremendous infrastructure needs, and in cooperation a lot of the time with the federal government, allowing those projects to be built. And so the expertise that has been developed in applying the public-private partnership model in the larger markets, Ontario and British Columbia, is being applied into the maritime provinces, and having hospitals and water treatment facilities and social infrastructure being developed out there. So it's shifted. And I think what we're also seeing is that not one model fits all projects. There's been a realization of that across the province, and it's starting to pivot. We're now, whether it's Ontario or any other province, and starting to pivot to, progressive models where there's a little bit, I'll call it the next phase of a public-private partnership. There's a little more collaboration as opposed to focusing on the risk transfer between public sector and private sector. I think in the template model, it worked very well. And I think as projects got larger and more complex, the shortcomings of it are being realized and seen on some projects across the country, and it's causing everybody to go back to the table and reassess and say, okay, well, what can change? In a progressive model where you have a little more transparency and you tackle the projects independently, makes quite a bit of sense.
So this latest spate of infrastructure projects is being funded how? What I'm really asking is the private investment dollars, where are they coming from? Are they coming from North America? Are you getting funds pouring in from Europe and Asia as well? Would you characterize where that money's coming from, the private dollars?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it, there's a combination. Players like ourselves, Fiera Infrastructure, we're a fund manager. We manage investments on behalf of our investors, and our investors are global. So we certainly have Canadian investors, but we have investors from the United States. We have investors globally. And when we invest in these types of projects in Canada, they all participate through our funds. We have an open-end fund, and all investors participate in the same assets. On the development side, I think what you commonly see is you see construction companies that have strong balance sheets. They like to invest in the projects that they're constructing. It's a unique kind of space where you see different types of investors coming in to get projects developed and then built and then operated over the longer term. We saw this opportunity ourselves, and we kind of took advantage of that by partnering with one of the largest construction companies in Canada, Ellis Don, where they invest in all the projects that they construct and they build. Our investors really benefit from the long-term nature of these types of assets that are delivered through the P3 model. And so we invest in those projects. All the projects that, once they're into operations, we invest in them. We're today invested in 16 P3 projects across the province. And these are long-term 20, 30-year concessions. So what happens is you have institutional investors that are participating. You have the construction companies themselves participating. And uniquely, I think, depending on the funds, and our fund being an open-ended fund, we also have it so that it's structured that high net worth individuals can be investing into our funds and gaining exposure to these exciting public infrastructure assets in Canada.
So whether it's FAERA funds or another organization, are there opportunities for high net worth individuals to invest, or is this strictly institutional money? For instance, what is the minimum investment to get involved?
Well, I think if you're talking about, getting invested into public infrastructure in these projects, in particular the P3 projects we're referring to, the best way is really through infrastructure funds, and high net worth investors have access to funds like ours and others to invest through feeder funds and gain exposure to them. I think that it's not direct investments that high net worth individuals would be able to make into these types of projects easily, and certainly not a common path. And frankly, I think it's really a risk exposure that, if you can diversify your risk by investing in through a FAERA infrastructure fund or others, and having a diversified portfolio of these types of assets, then you're well placed as a high net worth investor. And I think that, at the end of the day, you look at infrastructure as long term, and every investor, whether you're high net worth, institutional, you do look at the investments from what's the time horizon, what's the risk return that you're looking to achieve. And these are all long term projects. And when you think of the projects and companies that we invest in, they're long term. We take a long-term view to investing in them, and that's the premise of infrastructure when you're looking at investing in it.
So let's take a FAERA fund. What would the minimum investment be to play, and then what kind of hold time are you looking at as an investor, meaning an individual investor or an institutional investor should be prepared to be locked in for what, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years?
Well, it's actually a big benefit of investing in a FAERA infrastructure funds is the fact that we don't lock you in. So the minimum investments would be $5 million for a high net worth investor or even an institutional investor. But because we've structured our funds as an open-ended fund, we do allow redemption, and we allow the redemption of investors they need to exit the fund, they have the ability to exit. And it's one of the reasons why we took the approach of structuring it as an open-ended fund versus a closed-ended fund where you are locked in and you might have 10, 12 years where you're locked in and you cannot get your capital back until the manager of that fund starts to liquidate and wind down its investments. And, part of it is, from our decision, is an open-ended fund allows that broader spectrum of investors to really gain access to an exciting asset class. And infrastructure really has come in as its own asset class. And I think it allows you also, as an investor coming into a fund like FAERA Infrastructure, to gain that immediate diversification, because we have roughly 42 assets under FAERA Infrastructure today, 40 assets that sit within the funds. And when you come in to an IFIR infrastructure fund, you get immediate exposure to all those assets. You have diversification. We focus on the entire global mid-market infrastructure space. And that covers off things like public-private partnerships and social infrastructure, as we're talking about today. Those are really serve as stable, long-term investments. But what you also see in the Canadian market, and you see globally as well, that we look at telecommunications, we look at utility infrastructure, renewable energy, and as we were talking about earlier, transportation, which comes in all different forms, not necessarily through the public-private partnership structure. And so having that diversification across those five subsectors, I think, is key for investors to be considering.
So the redemptions are available, quarterly, biannually, annually?
Yep, we offer redemptions at any point in time that an investor is looking to redeem from the fund. Now, it's subject to, depending on the size of the redemption and the size of the investor, it's always dependent on, us. We'll look at capital available to draw in a new investor, or there can be a slight waiting period associated with that. We're proud to say we've had very little redemptions today. And so it's one where the investors are seeing the benefit of investing long-term in infrastructure, but the opportunity is there for them if they should consider to do so.
Now, as you mentioned earlier, assets, or let's think in terms of asset classes, that in the United States, in Congress, the Republican and Democratic parties have battled over what really constitutes infrastructure. Some people are pretty strict about this, saying roads and bridges and water systems, while other people say, get into broadband and some other areas that are more modern. And then, of course, there's always the battle over, lately it's been social infrastructure, which really doesn't have to do with building stuff. It has to do with funding certain, elements of society, people. Is there a well-defined and agreed-upon list of assets or asset classes within infrastructure in Canada? Or is that kind of a negotiable sort of thing, or something that people still argue about?
Well, we look at infrastructure, and I think the important way to look at infrastructure is going back to those assets and companies that are creating that backbone of the economy and that are essential to daily lives. I mean, I think that we look at social infrastructure, transportation, utilities, renewable energy, all of the things that we look at are. In our opinion, squarely infrastructure. Now, within each of those verticals and in those subsectors, there's constant innovation that's taking place. There's the consideration of, some of the newer items, I'd say, of is it infrastructure? And I think you start to look at the fundamentals of what they are. And I'll give you some examples. I think that, there's a intersection between infrastructure and real estate. We commonly now see data centers and cold storage facilities, which are, on the surface, real estate buildings, and real estate assets, but mm-hmm. they're very specialized. And there's a lot of automation and high barriers to entry to replicating a data center or cold storage facilities. And so those are now commonly invested by infrastructure funds. And we would argue that is infrastructure. Technology itself. There's technology that's being overlaid in all areas of what we would define as the traditional infrastructure spaces. And it is important to follow those trends of innovation and ensuring that what is infrastructure is continuing to evolve with time. And I think a great example is in the telecommunications space. Historically, a lot of people would look at telecommunications as a private equity investment. I think that what we've even all experienced, through the pandemic and what we continue to experience is that access to broadband and fiber optics and even cell communication towers, it's critical to our daily lives. And that's really evolved over time. But it's fairly commonly thought of as, it's become the fourth utility, gas, water, electric and now telecommunications. If you didn't have telecommunication access to our homes and in our daily lives, it would be challenging to operate. And as I got back to earlier, you know, think of the GDP of nations and the GDP of Canada is the fact that you need people communicating, you need people being able to live the essentials throughout their life and transportation, as we were referring to earlier. So it does evolve, is my point. And I think that at Fiera Infrastructure, though, we stay squarely within those five subsectors. And we do look at those subsectors as infrastructure. What we're not looking at, and where I think some participants globally are stretching the definitions of infrastructure, is things that are related to an infrastructure asset that are purely service related. There's no asset to it. There's no high barrier to entry. It can be easily replicated. We at Fiera Infrastructure do not see those as infrastructure plays.
Our guest again has been Ryan Gao. He's a director at Fiera Infrastructure in Canada, where a lot of infrastructure projects are underway, particularly in the transportation and energy spaces. Ryan, thank you for taking the time and coming on the program.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to speak with you.
This podcast has been sponsored by Juniper Square. Juniper Square is transforming the private capital markets industry with solutions and services that streamline fundraising, investment operations, and investor reporting. Designed for commercial real estate, Juniper Square is trusted by hundreds of investment sponsors to manage more than $1 trillion in real estate investments. Reach Juniper Square at junipersquare.com.